we're very excited this week to have with us Rabbi Yehoshua Rubinstein, who is a tremendously inspiring, funny, and very elevating lecturer. He's coming here from Manchester. This is part three of our legacy series, which deals with challenges. And we're very excited that he managed to find time in his very busy schedule to make it here this evening. So Rabbi Rubinstein.
The topic which was chosen for me tonight is angels, dreams, and demons. I noticed that Rabbi Ross has beat a hasty retreat because I don't have a lecture called Angels, Dreams, and Demons. I had to do a lot of work on this. What is an angel? I have a very, very good friend who's called Rabbi Moshe Kopetz. Rabbi Kopetz was the son-in-law of the late Manchester Rosh Hashiva. He's from New York, and he's a bit of a character. And when he was a young lad, he was going to attend in a Gudas Yisrael, like Dead Frum camp in New York, which was set up for Dead Frum boys. And it was gatecrashed by a certain Hasidic group. I won't mention which, because I'm incredibly tactful. But this Hasidic group came in, some boys of their own age, with vodka, and they... And they came into the dormitories, and they started to hand out the vodka and, you know, talk about stuff. And after quite a few vodkas, one of these guys turned around and said, he was incidentally from a Bells. Do you know Bells? Hasidim, you know, big fur, long pants, right? He's from that sort of family, and he said, you should be a Rebbe, a Hasid, a follower of our Rebbe. Our Rebbe is a Malach, an angel. He has no Yetzahara. Right? To which Rabbi Kopetz turned around in his inimitable style and said, well, if he's got no Yetzihara, he's no good to me, because I do have a Yetzihara. And in that there is an incredibly important message, which is, of course, if you go to see somebody because you have a difficulty and a worry, then the truth of the matter is, and this is a Jewish idea, it's contained in the sixth Perek of Pirkei Avos, Nosu ba'oinam chaveroi, the person you're talking to has to be able to understand what you're talking about. And if you sit down in front of a rabbi, a rebbetzin, a mentor, or whatever it is, a counselor, and you have to explain to them what your problem is and what your difficulty is and why you're hurt and why you're upset, that's the wrong person for you. You need somebody who understands what you're going through. And apparently he said, it was a very clever idea, that if he's got no Yetzihara, if angels are not possessed with any negativity, any drive to do things that are wrong, then by definition, it's no good to me, because I do. An angel would not understand what I did wrong, or why I wanted to do it wrong. And indeed, that's the function of an angel. Angels live in a place where they don't have a Yetzirah. And let's come across the first instance of angels in the Torah. That is to say, and this is very controversial in its own right, an awful lot of ink and indeed blood has been spilled over this one. In the beginning of Genesis, it says, God says, Nasa Odom Bitzalminu, let us make man, Kidmasenu, in our image. And of course, the problem is, who are the us? Right? God said, let us make man. Rashi says this was a wide open door for people to drive through their vehicles that proclaim there's more than one God. Let us make man. The Christians love this. You see? There's more than one God, or three parts, or four parts, if you're a Jesuit, depending on how you want to split God up. However, says Rashi, God knew about that, and it was more important to tell those people who've got ears to listen and eyes open, that the message is that what the us was when God created human beings, he first of all went to his heavenly court, the angels, and asked the angels, shall we make man? The idea is that if you have a position of authority, you should still include those people who are your inferiors in the decision-making process. And that was a lesson to get across. So let's move to that point of world history. God says to the angels, let us make man. What did the angels reply? Anybody know? No, that's not what they replied. Think about it. You don't need to know anything about this. This is logical. God said, let us make man. What did the angels say? Why? Nah. They argued. They did, but yeah, what was the basis of the argument? Before there was a question they posed before they got to why.
How do they know what man is?
Oh! The man's a genius! Yeah? How did they know what man was? So therefore the question was,
what is
a man? Right? There'd never been one before. Absolutely brilliant. Well done. What's a man? There'd never been a man before. God describes our nature. Our nature is that we can be his greatest servants. There is within us the potential to get higher than angels. Because after all, they don't have a Yetzirah. I mean, what is the challenge if you can only do good? That you and I have to sometimes confront our demons, which we'll come to in a second, and have to deal with our struggles and elevate ourselves and fight. That's a triumph. They don't have that. So we have the potential to be greater than angels or be God's greatest opponent, to revolt against God. A man can be a great saint, a woman can be a great saint, someone like me, or can be a camp guard at Auschwitz. Human beings have that potential. When that was described to the angels, then what did they say? Should we make man? What's a man? This is his nature. They said, no! Are you off your head? Well, they didn't say that to God because that would be disrespectful. But no, crazy idea. Right. God overrules them and creates humanity anyway. And if you remember in Pirkei Avot, in the fifth Pirkei, it says that there was 10 generations from Adam to Noah. And at that stage, what happens? Then the angels, well, the verse says, the Mishnah says, that humanity was so corrupt, so disgusting, and so repulsive, God had decided to wipe them out and start again. Okay? And let's turn to that bit in the Torah. And now I'm going to read to you a bit of Hebrew, just to show off. And you will see here that this makes no sense whatsoever. It says the following thing. And it was, Ki ha'echol ha'adam l'rov al-pnei adama, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, v'nasiyod al-lehem, and they had daughters, v'yiru b'nei ha'alekim es b'nasa adam, the men, the sons of God saw man, ki tovas hena v'ichol lehem noshim, they took wives, mikol ha'sher b'chor, from all they chose. V'yom ha'shem, and God said, lo yodon ruchi b'odam l'oilam, my soul will not judge man forever, b'shagam hu boser, because he's also flesh. And they give him another 120 years. And then we move to the next story. The next story is the story of Noah. And Noah makes a big boat. And he made the big boat to do what? To advertise to humanity that if they don't sort themselves out, there's a flood coming. Remember that bit? And here is a verse which is troubling in the extreme. God says, with regards to this whole thing, Kate's call, Boser Bolophonai, the end of all flesh has come before me. Because the world is full of violence and evil and nasty stuff. And what does it mean, the end of all flesh? Rashi is intrigued by the all. Kol mokom sha'atam maitzizinus. Every time you find sexual corruption permeating the fabric of human society, andromusia bola oilam. Andromusia, a destroying angel, comes to the world. V'harogim toivim v'roim. And it destroys both the good and the bad. This angel comes along and wipes everybody out. This is in the Seder of Noah. So if you find a sexually corrupt sort of society, then along comes a destroying angel and wipes them all out. What's the problem with that? In the Seder of Noah. Noah survived. So if Noah survived, who cares? The beginning of the Seder says, Noah each tzaddik, tomah hoya b'dorasav, he was a great tzaddik. Who cares? The agency, the vehicle through which God's going to destroy humanity, can't distinguish. It's an atom bomb. Atom bombs don't explode and say, oh, well, you're a good guy, I'll just move the radiation past you and get the other guy. Angels can't distinguish. So how come Noah and his family survive? Get the question? So let's go back to what we said before. At the end of the Seder of Bereishis, it talks about this strange story, and see if you can spot this. Now, in case you've never been to many of my shiurim before, or any shiurim a lot before, I have to tell you something which is going to sound flippant and silly, but I don't mean it to be. Whenever you're looking at the Chumash, or Torah, you've got to say to yourself the following thing. Who wrote it? God. Here's the bit that sounds silly, but I don't mean it to be. God's good at Hebrew. Right? And he is. Right? That means to say that if you find in the verse something that doesn't make sense, if it's in the masculine, it should be in the feminine. If it's the singular, it should be in the plural. If it's the past tense, it should be in the present tense. If the sentence is written and it takes 10 words in the posset to convey a message which could easily have been conveyed in 5 words, you've really got to ask yourself the question, why? God's good at Hebrew. You got that? If that's the case, I would like you to be Chumash Sherlock Holmeses. Okay? What's wrong with this? Right! And it was. When humanity started to multiply on the planet, and daughters were born to them. Do you get the problem? What's the problem? Everybody here over 16? Good. What's the problem with this? Sorry? Why? Because you're nearly there. Don't give up. This is it. Come on. Why mention the daughters? Oh, yes, the significance, right? It's do you remember the old song, Thank Heaven?
Yeah.
For little girls, right? Without them, what would little boys do? Right. So if man began to multiply, it's actually recorded. So, you know, in case you're selling the tape, I want royalties. If man, the passage says, began to multiply on the face of the earth, obviously they had daughters. Without them, what would little boys do? Right? You can't have multiplication of humanity without men and women. They marry. They settle down. They have children. But if there are only men, it's hard to multiply. Get the idea? So why does it say, when they began to multiply on the face of the earth, they had daughters? Well, they knew that, right? And they said, V'yira b'nei ha'elokim. And these sons of God see the Banos HaOdom, the daughters of man, Kitovasena. Who are these sons of God? And Rashi says that along came the angels after 10 generations. Remember, God had said to Adam, said to the angels, shall we make man? And they said no. And 10 generations later, when indeed man is corrupt, then along come the angels to God and effectively say, nah, 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 nah. Told you so. To which God says, and you think you could do a better job? To which the angel said, well, of course. He said, okay, off you go. And he puts them into this world. When they're in this world, they behave worse than us. And that sees B'nai Elohim. Because why did it say there are daughters born to them? Obviously they did. In those days, there were 7 times as many female births to male births. 7 times as many girls born as boys. There's a residue of that even today. You probably know that 51% of all births are female, right? I used to hear sometimes when I was on campus in the 70s, some feminists say that we're the oppressed minority. No, you're an oppressed majority. But there are more girls born even today than men. In those days, it was 7 to 1. Now we understand why it emphasizes the daughters. Obviously, daughters wouldn't be multiplying at all. But it's telling you that the scope of the daughters, 7 to 1. And then, along these angels come, who have now been put in human form, put into this world. And they see these Banos HaOdom, the daughters of man, Ki Tovatena, that they're beautiful. Apparently, they're all stunning girls. The Yikulahem Noshim. And they took for themselves wives. What should it say if you're good at Hebrew? The Yikulahem. There's a missing letter there. Le Noshim. They took them as wives. It's already established that we're talking about all these beautiful women, incredible, numerically superior, and it should say, and they took them for wives. But it doesn't say that. It says, V'yikulahem Noshim. What does that mean? Wives. They took wives. They took other men's wives. Even though there was an incredible surplus, it sounds crude to put it, but there was an enormous number of beautiful girls that they could marry, that they could choose, and they're beautiful. They preferred to take other men's wives, these angels. Mikol Asher Bechoro. And then, Mikol and Asher Bechoro, the rabbis say, then they chose men, and then they chose animals. In fact, they behaved much worse than we did. What's the Hebrew word for world? Olam. What does it mean? No, it means, it is used in that sense, you're right. Most Hebrew words have a 3-letter root. Ayin, Vav, Lamed, Mem. Olam is 4 letters, so you knock out the Vav and you're left with the root of the letter, which is Ayin, Lamed, Mem. That means hide or hidden. Why do we call this world by name, which means Olam, hidden? And the answer is, if you're God and you're going to create a world in which people have freedom of choice, the choice to look and find you, you'd have to hide the reality of your existence away. That happens here. But not up there. Angels see God clearly. So do angels have freedom of choice? When we live in this world where you can't see God, then you can choose to look for him. But if you could see God, do you have any choice? So do angels have choice? Not where they are. But if they are here, then they can choose. They're in a world where God is hidden. And when they were brought into this world, they behaved much worse than humanity had. And then we come to the next verse. Anybody good at Hebrew, please help me here, because this makes no sense at all. And the next verse says the following thing. It says, "V'yomer Hashem," God says, "Lo yodan ruchi ba'odam la'olam," my spirit will not judge man. "B'shagam hu boser," in as much as he is also flesh. "Well, you know, I'll give him another 120 years. He is also flesh. If he's also flesh, who else is flesh? Well, not God. God's definitely not flesh. This makes no sense. It doesn't translate. It's clumsy. It's hopeless. Except if you know one thing. If you look in Psalms, if you look in Borchi Nafshi, it says, the verse there, it says, "Bekoro malochov ruchos." He calls his angels spirits. Ruach is a euphemism for an angel. You get that? Now look at the verse. "Vayomer Hashem," and Hashem says, "Lo yodan ruchi ba'odam," my angel will not judge man. "La'olam," forever. "Shmishigam hu boser," he was also made flesh. And he behaved worse. People in glass houses can't throw stones. And therefore, even though it is the case when a destroying angel comes to the world, it can't distinguish between the good and the bad, the generation that was destroyed, Noah was saved because God saved Noah. An angel would not be able to distinguish, because people in glass houses can't throw stones. You behave worse than they did. Therefore, you can't be the agency through which they're punished. Does that make sense? Go back to the beginning. Therefore, why did God invite the angels to participate in the decision-making process for the creation of humanity in the first place? So that they would say no. So that 10 generations later they would come and say, "Nah, nah, 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 nah." And God would say, "Oh yeah, you could do a better job." And therefore they would come onto the planet and do a worse job, and therefore would be lifted out of their normal position, their normal role of being the judges. But they can't judge us because they don't understand us, and they don't understand our struggles. And when they were on the planet, then they did, and they behaved worse than we did. But an angel is a different creature. It sees God. It doesn't understand the struggles that you and I have, because we have a battle between our Yetzirah and our Yetzatov, between our demons, between the things inside us. And incidentally, the Hebrew word for demon is a shin dalad, a shade. And Rabbi Dessler says that intrinsically you can see that a demon is something from within. It's the negative side of your nature. That, the evil side, something you hear inside your head, a voice that says and tells you to do things which is so corrupt and so repulsive to you, you have to shout and get out. You don't want to hear it. But it's part of you. That's what a demon is. A shin dalad, a shade, is that part, that negative part of your nature, says Rabbi Dessler. How do dreams work? Rabbi Dessler, in his essay on the subject, cites three categories of dreams. Three functions for dreams. But there's a fourth. The fourth is mentioned in the Gemara in Brochus in Daf 56a. Page 56a. So let's read that Gemara. Here the Gemara says, an interesting story. Apparently, Omar lay the keys of Rabbi Shua bar Chanina. Caesar, the Caesar of Rome, once spoke to Rabbi Shua ben Chanina, and he said to him, "Omrita de chachmita tuva." It said that you Jews are very clever. Now, I pause at that point. Anybody here go to non-Jewish school or university? If somebody non-Jewish in either of those settings comes up to you and says, "You Jews think you're so clever," what is that usually a precursor to? A smack in the mouth. Right? It's usually a punch in the nose, a smack in the mouth, or at least a verbal insult, right? So here we've got the most powerful man on the planet at the time, the Caesar of Rome, and he says to this rabbi, to Rabbi Shua bar Chanina, "Omrita," it said, "Zachachmita tuva," you Jews are supposed to be very clever. Okay, "Emoni machazina bachalamai," so tell me what I'm going to dream about tonight. What would you do? Remember, this is the Caesar of Rome. Caesars are not used to having their requests rejected or not fulfilled. If they're annoyed because you can't give them what they want, they might just remove your head from its normal location. Right? And here he says, "Tell me what I'm going to dream about tonight. How would you react?" The Gemara says this rabbi didn't blink an eyelid. Amalei chazina de meshachal parsoi. He immediately replied and said, "The king of the other empire, the one that's in competition to yours, the Persian Empire, and sometimes under the Parthian Empire, you will dream that he's going to conquer you. He's going to take you as a slave. And not only that, he's going to make you a swineherd, look after his pigs, and you'll do so using a golden stick, a golden staff. The Gemara says the following thing. Guess what? Here, Herculeum, he was so upset by that, that he thought about it all day long. And at night time, guess what he dreamt? And he thought that rabbi was dead clever. That's one category of dreams. But Rabbi Nessa, there's three other reasons for dreaming. Now consider this before we get into this in depth. We're asking ourselves the question, why does God make us dream? After all, he could have created us that we don't dream. But the real question we're trying to investigate tonight is, why did he make us dream? What's the purpose and function? And Rabbi Nessa says three functions for a dream. Function number one is that a dream can show you a side of your nature or part of your personality which is negative and which you need to attend to. So imagine a dream in which you are flying through a cloud. You are a marshmallow, right? When you get to the other side of the cloud, you zoom down and land in a lake of chocolate. You swim to the side, and there you see your husband, your wife, your father, your mother, or your child. They say something to you, you get angry and slap them across the face. And on you go, into your bag, and you get sealed, ready to put in the shelf in the shop. Right? Okay. So, thank you. Now, obviously the vast majority of that is total garbage, right? What element within the dream might distress you? The slapping. Right? So there could be a revelation within the dream of something in your personality, in your nature, which is negative, which needs to be addressed. Why is it contained within a dream? Rashi says, the Gemara reports, that 59/60 of a dream is total garbage, total nonsense. But 1/60 is an element of clarity, and indeed, as we'll see in a second, even could be an element of prophecy. So a 60th is right, is real. But why is it encased within a model which is totally junk? It's just total nonsense. And the answer is quite simple. How easy do people find it in general, if you want a hypothetical question, or if you feel like being very honest with yourself, how honest do you find it or feel it to accept criticism? Think about the last time somebody close to you said, you know the problem with you? Before we get to the specifics of what he or she thinks the problem is, what was your reaction? Just with this, do you know the problem with you? How did you feel as the hair bristled in the back of your neck? Oh yeah, you want to tell me a problem with me? Well, this is son, I'll tell you the problem with you! Especially if you come from Glasgow. We're not very good at accepting criticism. One of my teachers was somebody called Rabalta Halpin, and his father-in-law was somebody called Ramosha Schneider, who set up the first yeshiva, successful yeshiva, in England. Not in Gateshead, not in the northeast, here in London. It's called Schneider's Yeshiva. If he wanted to criticize one of the boys in the yeshiva whom he'd seen doing something wrong, this is how he would do it. First of all, he'd go into the study hall, the base of Medrash, and he would take the boy outside. Then he would walk with him with his arm around the boy's shoulder. Then he would say the following thing. Before he got to the subject he was concerned about, he'd say, you know, if you go into a garage and the mechanic comes out from underneath the car, and as he's getting out from underneath the car to come and see you, a drop of oil plops itself onto his overalls. Will you say to him, oh, you've got a stain in your overall? No. Why not? Because it's covered in stains. He's a mechanic, for goodness sake, right? But suppose you go to a chasna, and there is the bride in her beautiful white dress, and she's got a tiny little black thread in her bodice or in her shoulder. Or you see the chosin, the groom, in a black suit, and he's got a tiny little bit of dandruff on his jacket. Will you point that out to them? Well, yes, because that tiny little thing spoils the rest. With that introduction, he would say, I saw you do something. I heard you say something. It's spoiling you. Now, in that way, it's easy to accept the criticism. First of all, he's taking you away from other people, so you're not embarrassed by the criticism. Secondly, he's put his arm around your shoulder. In other words, he's telling you, I love you. Thirdly, he's saying that apart from this flaw, this mistake, this slip-up, you're pretty dash perfect. Right? And that way it's far easier to accept the criticism. Yeah? But if it is the case that you get the criticism head on, we'll reject it. If God wants to signal to you, remember we're asking why God makes this dream. If God wants to signal to you in the form of a dream that there's something you need to improve in yourself, it's much easier to accept it if you were a marshmallow at the time, right? And you're flying through the chocolate lake or whatever. Most of it's nonsense, but it might be that that serious bit that you're uncomfortable with might challenge you to say, am I capable of smacking my father, or smacking my mother, or smacking my wife? And maybe you would deal with that. So one of the purposes and functions of a dream is to alert you to something negative that lies within your personality. Another purpose and function of dreams is the one that people get very excited about, a 60th of prophecy. Sometimes a dream can be a glimpse into a possible future. I've got a very, very good friend, used to be in California, he's now in New York. In fact, I was lecturing for him just a few weeks ago in New Jersey, and the last time I was in California a couple of years ago, he told me that the week before he'd had a very, very distressing and disturbing dream. He woke up from the dream in which he saw his teenage daughter, who was asleep in the door in the bedroom next door, drowning and had drowned. And it was one of those dreams that, you know, terrible nightmare, terribly clear. She drowned. So he leant over to his wife to tell her that, you know, what the terrible dream was. He was upset to see that she was already awake and she was looking pretty distressed as well. So he said to her, what's wrong? She said, a terrible dream. What? She dreamt that their teenage daughter had drowned. So what does a good mum and Jewish mum and dad or any mum and dad do if they both dream the same thing, like that? They rushed in to see how the girl was. And she was fine, thank God. Except she was very upset because she'd had a dream. She dreamt that she drowned. So they asked one of the giants of the generation, something called Ramosha Shapiro, and he said, Mistamos istus. Probably it's nonsense. However, you should fast. And they fasted. Actually, when I was talking to him, he said, this went on for a long time, this dream, of them all having it. Okay? And it's possible for a dream to be a glimpse of a possible future. Now, at this point, before you're getting all upset, I've got to tell you two important things. The Talmud in Brachah says, a bad dream's better than a good dream. A bad dream is better than a good dream. Obviously, we'll have to understand why. Not only that, the Gemara says that if you have a week without a dream, that's bad. We'll have to understand why that is too, okay? So, and incidentally, as it's only a 60th of prophecy, I don't know if you know this, but if I was a real prophet, and I came along and said something very bad is going to happen to you or to the Jewish people, does that have to come true? No. The rule is that if a prophet says something positive, something good, for the future of the Jewish people, that must happen. But if a prophet prophesies something bad, that doesn't have to happen without in any way that jeopardizing his status as a prophet. If he says something good and it doesn't come true, he's not a prophet. He's a phony. God always keeps good predictions through proper prophets. But if God sent a message through a proper prophet that something bad's going to happen and it doesn't happen, that may only indicate that God changed his mind because the person changed their behavior or other reasons, hundreds of other reasons. So if I was a proper prophet, a real prophet, and I told you something bad was going to happen, it need not necessarily come true. So in case you had a bad dream last night or you have one tonight, right, don't panic. Okay? But again, the same raison d'etre as to why God makes us dream as in the first category comes into this category as well. When the dream shows you something negative that lies within your personality, it's in order for you to address that and change that. If you have a dream that shows you a prediction of something negative that might happen to you, you're going to address that and change yourself so that that doesn't happen. But the third category of dreams is very interesting. It's like the first one. That is to say that sometimes you can be shown in a dream something within yourself that isn't negative. Something within yourself that's positive. Something within yourself that you were unaware of before you had the dream. A prediction, if you like, of greatness, showing yourself some greatness that you possess, that you were unaware of. All of these I'll illustrate to you. And of course, the Torah's famous story of the dreams, we just left it a few sedras ago, but of course, the story of Joseph and his brothers. And when Joseph and the brothers in the Seder of Yeshev, of course, this is great, creates great animosity between the two, or between all of them. I'm going to read to you the Hebrew again, and remember God's good Hebrew. So this is your second chance to be Sherlock Holmes's. Of course, there's animosity between the brothers and Joseph before we get to the dreams, because what happened? Yaakov had made Joseph a what? A coat of many colors, right? Well, did he? Rashi says that it's the Hebrew's ketonet pasim. Pasim, says Rashi, is fine wool. Not many colors, but fine wool. What's a ketonet? So you can see that, says something called the Alshech, because when they take him out from the pit, right, where they were going to kill him, but they put him in this pit, they take this garment, this ketonet, me alov, from on him. Now, is my jacket on me? No. My jacket's on my shirt. Is my shirt on me? No, it's on my talus cotton. Is my talus cotton on me? No, it's on my vest. Is my vest on me? Yes. So what did Yaakov make Joseph that caused all the animosity and the jealousy? A woolly vest, right? I mean, exactly. Imagine Joseph, you know, swaggering in and saying to the brothers, Dad likes me the best. He made me a woolly vest. I mean, you can imagine the brothers going, maybe I should make a pair of socks next. I mean, how jealous can you be of a woolly vest? On the other hand, of course, it doesn't make a good title for a musical. I mean, Joseph and the Woolly Vest, no. Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat, okay. So they don't like him already. And yet, straight after that, there's another incident in the Torah which says the following thing. It says, V'yachlam Yosef chalam. After it says, Lo yachlam dabar lo shalom, the brothers were not able to speak to Joseph in peace. V'yachlam Yosef chalam, Joseph dreamt a dream. V'yagad le'echov, and he told it to his brothers. But Yosef otzlam asal, and he hated them even more. But Yomalem, he said to them, Shimono ha'chalam azeh asher chalamti. Listen to this dream, what I have dreamed. V'hine anachnom olum olum betach asadi. We were binding sheaves of corn in the middle of the field. V'hine kama olum asi, and my sheaf of corn stood erect. V'gamnit sova and higher. V'hine tzuzaben olum asechem, and your sheaves of corn surrounded mine. V'shtikaven olum asi, and bowed down to my sheaf of corn. V'yomer lo echav, and the brother said to him, Hamloch timloch alina, will you really be a king over us? Imoshal tim shabona, will you really rule over us? V'yosifa otzno asan, they hated him even more. Achalom asaf for his dreams, v'aldavarovim for his words. Famous story, right? All with me? Makes no sense at all. Makes no sense at all. Why does it make any sense? Well, first of all, it doesn't make any sense because all of the brothers of Joseph and Joseph himself were prophets. How was it that a prophet generally got a prophetic message from God, you know? Maimonides says, in a dream. Either a dream at night time when he or she was asleep, or during the day when they went into sort of like a daydream or a trance, and then they would get the message. Okay, that was what it was about. Now, they're prophets, and he's prophets. He's a prophet. He comes and said, I've had a dream. Normally you would expect at the time to say, oh well, what is this? Instead of that, they reject it completely. Another question is, what was the dream? The dream was, he said, we were standing, binding sheaves of corn in the middle of the field. My bundle of corn was higher than your bundle of corn. And then your bundles of corn bowed down to my bundle of corn. Now, interestingly, of course, this is prophecy. This is a message from God. Why don't they understand this? They turn around and say, interesting, they reverse it. You see, if I'm standing higher than you, I'm a ruler. I rule over you. If you bow down to me, well, who do you bow down to? Apart from God? Kings. Right? So, he says, my sheaf of corn was higher than yours. Right? I.e., I will rule over you. And then you'll bow down to me. Then I'll be king over you. But they said to him, will you really be a king over us? Will you really rule over us? They reversed the order. Why did they reverse the order? You got that? Bit tricky that one. You with me? Okay, and here's the cracker, and that is, maybe you'll get this yourself. I'll read this bit to you again. But Yarmala Echav Amlak Tim Lachalim, we really rule over us. Imoshal Tim Shimoni, we really be a king. Sorry, they don't know about me. Be king over us. You really rule over us. But Yosefu Odsno also, and they hated me even more. Al Chalom Asof for his dreams, for Aldavarov and for his words. Focus on the last four words. They hated him for his dreams and for his words. What's the problem with that? Sherlock's. What? That's true. Something more fundamental.
The dreams
weren't
his.
His words rather. No, you're missing something far more fundamental. What? No. No, incidentally, the Rambam says because a God could give a message to one prophet just for him, or to share to another individual, or to a whole group, right? So it could be that it just wanted him to know it. You're missing something so fundamental, you're going to kick yourself. They hated him, I'll do it again, for his dreams. Good! He'd only told one dream. And the pasuk emphasizes that. Vayachlam Yosef chalom. And Joseph dreamt a dream. And he told the dream to his brothers. And they hated him for his dreams. To understand that, we've got to go back to the example of dreaming and why you dream. That when I told it to you, you laughed at the beginning because it was funny. But it's actually crucial and is the key to understanding this whole incident. Right? And that was the dream about which Caesar demanded that this rabbi would tell him what he was going to dream that night. Do you remember that? And he says you're going to have that. He gives them this frightening image, and guess what? He dreamt about it. You see, there are sorts of dreams which you have, which aren't the sort of dream that we're talking about here. Martin Luther King famously said, if his most famous words were, "I have a dream." Right? Now, in this sense, he doesn't mean I fell asleep just before I got up to speak here, you know, in Washington, D.C. I was having some coffee, but it didn't keep me awake. No, it doesn't mean that, right? In this sense, I have a dream means I have an aspiration, a vision, a hope, a plan. And you see, that's what they think this is. Because what did he dream? He said that I am going to be the ruler over you. Then I'm going to be the king over you. They say, will you really be the king over us? Will you really rule over us? Why did they reject this as possibly being prophecy? Because it was mental. It made no sense. Why? Can you be the king of 10 people? No. You can't be the king. You can be the gaffer. You can be the boss, the leader. But you can't be the king of 10 people. A king is a king, well, in the ancient world, of a city-state. Certainly the king of a country. And certainly the king of an empire. But you can't be the king of 10 people. As that bit of the dream is clearly nonsense, then it's not prophecy, and the other bit is obviously nonsense as well. That's why they reversed it. He said, I'm going to rule over you, I'll be a king over you. They said, oh, you're going to be a king of 10 people? Nonsense. And the other bit must be nonsense as well. This, therefore, is not prophecy. This is dreams plural. This dream that you're reporting that you dreamt at night is the product of your I have a dream and ambition, what you're thinking about, planning, and hoping through your waking hours. Do you get this? Now you understand why they rejected that. That's the plural, the dreams. But you know, think for a second. And this is not pleasant to do, but I'd like you to do this just to help me here. I want you, and I'm going to pause, to think of all the worst possible things that could happen to a person in his or her life. And I mean worst. That could happen to a person in his or her life. No? Give me examples. Sorry? To lose a child. Good.
Good. Amputation.
Oh, okay. Okay. Don't say that. Okay. Yeah. Die in a gas chamber. Okay. Blind. So yes. Lose all your money. Yeah. Very Jewish, terrible one. Yeah. Scottish and Jewish. Tragedy. Should be like me and have none to begin with. Yeah. Yeah? To be abused. Give me an example of abuse. Okay, raped. Yeah? Physically abused. Beaten. Emotionally abused. Anything else?
Divorce.
Sorry?
Divorce.
If you like, divorce.
Lose a family member.
How about death? Right. Dying's no good. Right. But of course, there are things that are worse than dying. There are some things that people can do to other people which will cause them to say, I wish I could die. Torture's no good. The Talmud says that all of those, have you got all those fixed in your mind? All of those are the constant daily worry and companion of a slave. Slaves had no rights whatsoever in the ancient world. In Imperial Rome, they had slave farms. You were sold as a product of the farm, aged 9. Male or female, for whatever use the purchaser wants to put you to. Whether it's as a sex object, whether it's a slave in the fields or in the mines, And if your master wants to starve you to death, if your master wants to beat you up, amputate a limb, rape you, torture you, and indeed murder you, you can't phone the police. You're merely property. So that's the constant daily companion. You give me all the worst things that can happen to a person in their lives, all of them could happen to a slave. And that's the constant worry of a slave. So suppose you were a slave, and the worst place of all to be a slave was Egypt. The Pasuk says, we say it in the Haggadah, that everything they did to the slaves was with rigor. They treated them really, really nastily. And not only that, we know we have a tradition that before the Jews get out in the Exodus story, no slave ever escaped from Egypt. So it's a life sentence. And suppose all of that was the reality of your life and you had been condemned to that by your brothers, by those who should have loved for you and cared for you the most and secured you the most and protected you the most. They sold you into that. I've got news for you. Even the greatest, even the holiest, sometimes despaired. How do we know that? King David said, Keli, Keli, lama azoftoni. My God, why have you abandoned me? Sometimes even the greatest can't see. The problem, of course, is theirs. God can see, but I don't know, what's the point? What have I done wrong? Why did you do this to me? And imagine all of that. Now imagine there's a bit of light at the end of the tunnel. You're employed, or rather you're taken and bought by a guy called Potiphar. He's very, very wealthy, and he happens to, you know, be in charge of meat production for the Egyptian Empire, and he has a stunningly beautiful wife. Everybody likes you a lot. The master likes you, all the other servants like you. You're promoted to be the major domo, the head of the household, and of course the problem is that somebody else liked you as well. The mistress. And she tries to get you to commit adultery. And as the Posset report, she says, sleep with me several times. Commit adultery with me several times. And Joseph refuses and refuses and refuses. Despite that fact, she accuses him. He is put in trial and convicted and found guilty. And of course, he didn't. He was tempted. He nearly did, but he ran away. And he's thrown into jail. Why? For passing the test. Could you turn around and say, Kaylee, Kaylee, lama azavtani? What have you done that to me for? I passed the test. The name of Jew is dirt in Egypt. Because of me. Because I remained loyal to you. And I passed the test. And this is what he did to me. But he didn't say that. Because he'd had a dream. And in the dream, he was shown that he's going to be a king. He has that potential. That's opened up to him. And that allowed him to realize that potential, to keep going. And eventually that was going to come true. The brothers couldn't see. How can you be the king of 10 people? How can we possibly bow down to you? They couldn't see that in the future God was going to make him the king of a country, of Egypt. And they'd bow down to him as the king of a country. That's why they rejected it. But it was also a message to him that kept him going through the darkest times. There's a very, very famous rabbi called the Netziv. He lived about 200 years ago. His name is Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. And when he completed learning the Talmud again for yet another cycle, the whole Talmud, he made a celebratory kiddush, or a lunch, and he invited some of his Talmudim together, and he told them the following story. Apparently, it was a true story. He said that when he was learning in yeshiva in Darheim, in the old country, he went through a period when he was messing about, not taking it very seriously. And one night he heard his parents discussing what would be the outcome, what would be the fate, or should be the fate for this boy. Because obviously he's not cut out for yeshiva. So they decided what they should do is get him apprenticed to a trade, to a craft. And after that, we'll see what he does with his life. He was very upset by this. He knocked on the door, went in and said, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to overhear. But please, give me another 6 months. Let me prove that I can do it. Gave him a fright. He took it seriously. And indeed, he gave him the 6 months trial, and he proved, and he passed the test. He took it seriously. He became one of the greatest rabbis of his generation. But he said to his audience, but suppose I had not taken it seriously. Suppose instead I become apprenticed. Let's say I become a jeweler. And after I'm a qualified jeweler, let's say I go and live in America. I go to New York. And I open a little store there. I meet a very nice Jewish girl. And I settle down with a family, and that's that. One day I'm standing in front of the heavenly court and they say, and who are you? And I say, me, I'm Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. And they say, okie dokie, let's just get down your file. When we're getting it down, says the heavenly court to him, tell us something about yourself. So, well, I was born in the old country, and then I moved to New York. I opened a couple of jewelry shops. It was a success. I married a nice Jewish girl. We were religious and loyal to the Torah and mitzvahs. We kept Shabbat. We kept Taras Mishpacha, Kashrut. We had six kids. The kids all grew up from. I went to Shiurim. And then eventually I died. Actually, just a few seconds ago, really. I said, oh, yes, Mr. Berlin. Okay, Mr. Berlin, we got your file now. Tell us, Mr. Berlin, have you ever heard of a Jewish work called Hemek Dover? Hemek Dover. It's a commentary on the Chumash. We say, Hemek Dover. No. Okay. Mr. Berlin, have you ever heard of a book called, a Jewish work called Hemek Brocha? Hemek Brocha. I don't think so. You wrote them. Pardon? You wrote them. Sorry, wrong name. Natali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the jeweler from Manhattan. I mean, look, I went to Shiurim and stuff like that, but I didn't write books. But you could have. But you could have. That's what he said to them. I remember when I was 3 years ago seeing Shiurim in California, I went to a place called Calabasas. And when I went into Calabasas, I gave a shiur there. There was about 60 people at somebody's house. And after I finished giving the shiur, a guy came up to me with a copy of my book. And he said to me, I bought your book 6 months ago. Would you mind writing something in it for me? And I said, yeah, no problem. So I started to write something in the cover. He said to me, it's my Shabbos treat. I said, what do you mean? So this is a fellow who came from a non-religious background and had grown in his loyalty and liking of religious Judaism. And the graduated from the point of not just keeping Shabbos, but actually coming to the difficult thing of coming to terms with text, you know, with struggling with Hebrew and the Chumash and all that stuff, which ain't easy. And he told me that this is his phrase, quote, I forced myself to study Chumash with Rashi, translating it 2 hours on a Shabbos afternoon. After that, I learned the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch for a further hour. And if I complete my 3 hours successfully, I reward myself by reading a chapter of your book. I have to tell you, it's worth going to California just to hear that, right? But suppose I hadn't written that book, Dancing Through Time. Suppose I hadn't written that book. And one day I'll be standing in front of the Beis Din Shamalo and they'll say, who? Yehuda Yonah Rubinstein. Okay? Have I heard a book called Dancing Through Time? No. How about Where Time and Destiny Meets? No. You wrote them! Me? I come from Glasgow. I went to end up a books, right? You could have. A dream can be a revelation of who you could be. Who you could be. Angels don't understand us. Angels don't have any struggles. And when a couple of them came down, boy, they were worse than we are. But angels don't understand that it's difficult to grow. We have to confront our own demons. And the dream can be an insight as to how you could do it. First of all, that you do have demons. A dream can be a glimpse as to, you know, a negative bit of your personality that invites you and allows you to change. A dream can be a glimpse of what could happen to you if you don't confront those demons. And lastly, a dream can be a glimpse of the fact that you could be superior to angels. Better than them. Greater than them. Every single one of you could literally change and grow to be the sort of person who can inspire hundreds and thousands of others. That's the purpose of dreams. So much for angels and so much for demons. The real thing to be is a human being who's growing. Thank you very much.
What about the majority of dreams, which are just forgotten the moment you wake up and they leave perhaps a sense of unease, but you cannot, dreams are not exactly remembered so perfectly.
See, I speak fluent Italian, one word. The answer to that is, have you heard the question, but what if you don't remember the dreams? That's a very good question. The answer is quite simple. It doesn't have to be that you remember every detail of the dream. Generally, the negative bit is going to stay in your mind anyway. But even if you've got no conscious recollection of the dream at all, the fact it might be that you are subconsciously aware of an element that was shown to you in the dream. I forgot to say to you in the shiur, incidentally, why is a bad dream better than a good dream? It's because if God's sending you a dream, and even a bad dream, which is an invitation for you to change, It is a sign that he's still in touch with you, concerned about you, and thinks you could change. But if you don't have any bad dreams, in fact, if you don't dream at all, it could be a sign that you're a write-off. No point in sending him a dream to subtly suggest to him to change. You could send along a bunch of angels with trumpets, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning. He'll stand at the foot of his bed and go, wake up, become better, shut up, you know, and go underneath the quilt, right? So a dream is a possibility, offers a possibility of change. Even if you don't recollect all the details, it might be, it's happened to me many times. My mum, Zollzein Gesunden Stark, she talks about breaking a dream. She'll dream about, I've had this many, I do this myself. You have a dream, you even forget about the dream, but something happens to you after that, you think, oh, I dreamt about that. My mum used to call that breaking a dream, right? Let me say, I've consciously forgotten about it, but it was there all the time subconsciously, i.e. when something happens which relates to it, I remember the dream. So as long as subconsciously you're aware, let's say you slapped somebody in a dream, it might be that you're more sensitive to that issue, right? So you don't have to remember it necessarily with clarity and consciousness. Yeah, hi. Then you die. The Gemara says you don't sleep at all, you'll die. So nobody is insomnia to the degree where they never sleep. I mean, you actually, I'm not being flippant. I mean, if you never sleep, you do die. Okay. So as long as you're... Sorry? Again, you... Most people dream. Exactly. Most people dream, and you can test because there's something called REM. Yeah, a pop group. No, there's REM, which stands for rapid eye movement, which is the way they record, they tell a person's dreaming, because your eyes are flickering up and down, right? Usually as you're coming out of sleep. And most people are dreaming. You can test that next time you see a little brother, little sister. As we said before, it doesn't have to be so crystal clear in your conscious mind. As long as the awareness and the sensitivity to the issue is still pertinent and running about your subconscious mind, it might work. Is that another question? Ah, she done. And? Yeah?
If you're even aware of her when you're alone, like when you're awake, can that obtain dreams?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. As long as you're in a... Look, the job of a Jew is to grow, right? And, you know, it's very nice God sending you a message. But if you're actually addressing that issue yourself by a conscious, you know, program of change and growth, then I suppose he doesn't have to send you the message to get rid of the anger because you got rid of it yourself. Sir?
Just looking at an angel in fact, nothing more than Hashem sending a message to a human being. Or otherwise, how would you define an angel?
A force. I call it a spiritual robot. It can, and I mean, the question is, why does God need angels? That would be a different question, really. The answer is, I mean, we've got a general idea of kings and queens, or certainly kings, as being what's called in Hebrew a dugma, an illustration of the King of Kings. The idea of how we relate to a king, especially when we're talking about a classical king who's the power of life and death, is supposed to give you a feel of what your relationship to God might be. Does that make sense, yeah? So, basically, if that is the case, you're very unlikely to find a king when they really had kings like czars and stuff like that who would phone you up and say, I'd like you to come down to the palace for a drink. Right? They have secretaries. It's not covered for the king to make the phone call himself. They have agents and servants who do it. And they're generally lords and dukes, people who are, you know, themselves quite inspirational. That's why God uses angels. It's not covered for him to, but their function, if you like, they're like a spiritual robot. They can destroy cities like Sodom and Gomorrah. They can kill individuals or turn them to pillars of salt like Lot's wife, etc. They actually are sentient beings. They think, they recognize each other, and they have a mindset, but they're in a different dimension to us.
Are they part of Hashem?
No. Well, I don't know how you define part of Hashem. Our soul is supposed to be part of Hashem as well. The word for soul also means breath. Neshama is a breath. That means to say that our souls were breathed in. The soul was breathed in by God into the body of Adam. Right? That means that a breath comes from you without being a part of you. So don't think that you're a little God. Right, human being, right? The soul came from God, but isn't a part. A breath comes from you, but isn't a part of you. Okay? So they're not part of God. We don't believe that God has parts. That's Christianity. One. That, again, the chelik and the kamimal idea, the fraction of God, is this idea of a breath, but not reality, not actuality. Yeah, at the back. You mean, is God speaking through me? Well... Well, God speaks to us through the Torah, and I'm not telling anything that's my own ideas. I was just, you know, amplifying Torah ideas. So in that sense, yes. But does God speak through Yehuda Yad Rubinstein directly? Probably not. No, no, I don't think so. Sir?
You know how you always hear people say, you know, well, I mean, you hear it in the newspapers or whatever, they say, you know, I have my guardian angel and he saved me today from something, or like if I call out something, you know, an angel will come and help me with something or something like that.
Which newspapers are you reading?
No, I'm sure people have heard. I mean, you haven't heard a story of someone who would have said, you know, I don't know why I did this, but, you know, then I suddenly saw something and made me do this. You know, like a guardian.
Yeah, okay, okay, okay. Yeah, okay, if you like. Yeah, okay, if you like. Yeah, could be. Yeah.
Would I like a marooning case?
No, 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 I'm saying, no, no, I agree, yeah. I'm saying, no, you look quite sane to me, actually. My last year was a real nutter there right now. No, you look all right. No, the basic idea, I'm saying that it could be that when God intervenes in your life, the example you're giving, right, you can express that in terms of guardian angel if you like, because generally when God has an intervention in this world, he does use the agency of an angel. So you want to say that that's my guardian angel? That's fine. But the same idea when a person keeps Shabbat, like an idea that he's escorted back from shul, and the angels by angels, and when they come into the house, they say, ah, Shabbos is ready, the table is set, it's all the way it's meant to be. So it will be a good angel and a bad angel. The good angel says, that's what it's got to be next week, and the bad angel, the Yetzirah, says, amen. If, however, there's no Shabbat there, then the bad angel says it should be this way next week, and the good angel, the guardian angel, has to say amen as well. So it should be. So there is that sort of idea as well. Yeah, okay. No, I don't think it's a constant companion. Yeah, in fact, can you sit over a bit because he's squished? Sorry,
excuse me. Don't we say we mean Michael? We know exactly where they are.
You see these firmers, they will get in here with their questions, yeah. Yes. Yes. You do. We do say that. We say it before we go to bed at night. We mean every foil, etc. Yeah, but I mean, we all say that. So you can't be your particular guardian angel. The angel for dreams, incidentally, is called Gabriel. Mr. Fine Messiah. Yes, yeah.
Very one thing, like talking about dreams, etc., and making it hard for us to give out the guidelines. So when we have the dream, how do we tell what it
takes? That's an excellent question. He's one of my students, incidentally. the question was, how do you know what the message of the dream is? Okay? Let's go back to that. We said the dream is the 60th of prophecy. Okay? So, as we no longer have prophets anymore, if you had an incident in your life, when we had prophets, you would go to the prophet and say, what is this? And they would tell you, or, you know, this, that, and the other. This is what you should do. But we don't have prophets anymore. I remember in my own life, two major crises occurred, and we went to Gateshead to discuss them with my Rav. At the time, the Gates of Rovzak Hassan Ibrocha and Ramatzio Solomon, and both said the same thing. And we're looking for, why did this happen? What's the message? What should I be doing right? And they both said the same thing. There are no prophets anymore. However, whatever you can take out from this incident that you think you could improve on, that's the message. So if you have a dream, like the one I gave as an example, where you slap somebody, right? If that's distressing to you and disturbing you, that's what you should be improving. But certainly you're right. Don't go rushing about, you know, because you had a dream and say, ah, I must do that. If it's really distressing to you, remember the example I gave you of my friend who dreamt about his daughter drowning. They asked a big rabbi. If you have a very distressing dream and you're not quite sure what you should do, get in touch with a big rabbi. About 6 foot one would do, you know. Yeah. Like they did. Like this family did it, go and discuss it with the rabbi. I mean, there's various things which, for example, he said fast. Normally, the prescription for a bad dream is for you to give tzedakah. Normally, you give money to charity, right? The Rabbi Y.Y. Rubenstein Bahamas Holiday Account Fund is a particularly good charity. But if that doesn't work, then you really should take your question to a rabbi. If you took it to me, I mean, I wouldn't know, I'm just not that skilled, but I'd be able to refer you on up to somebody who would be expert enough to give you a prescription for what to do.
What if you have like a bad, vivid, memorable dream like every day? Like literally, I wake up and every day I remember my dream.
Well, that would be the exact same formula, but I'd just like to see how beautiful your accent is. No, oh yes? I don't think I would know that unless it was a parrot. What a pretty dream! What a pretty dream! Yeah, I don't know. I don't know of animals' dreams. I'm not. You mean because you see the most rapid eye movement? You mean sort of like? I mean, what's the basis of your question? Have you seen an animal you think's dreaming, like a dog with flickering?
You said about the flickering of the eyes.
As I'm saying, so you think maybe you've seen an? I don't know. I wouldn't worry your cat. Oh gosh, here we go about cats and dogs. Right? I'm not sure, but it certainly doesn't impact on you. If they're having dreams, I'm afraid that's tough. and they certainly can't go and ask a rabbi. Yeah.
Five, six people dreaming same dream, and they come to you. And
yeah.
You are a big rabbi.
I am actually. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you give answer to all of them same?
It depends how much they pay me. You said all the same dream?
All day, same dream.
The Talmud in Brachos discusses it. The Talmud talks about two rabbis who constantly dream the same dream. Oh, incidentally, I should have thrown in, but we're running out of time. If you have a bad dream, it only comes true if you believe it will come true.
No bad or good. Same dream, I mean five different people. Old, young, teenager, boys 5 years old.
When they have teenagers 5 years old? Where do you come from?
Any age they come for different...
Yeah, so therefore...
They dream same.
Right, okay, and the question is...
Are you going to tell them same story if you're going to tell them really what is the dream meaning?
Might be. But the Talmud talks about that. The Talmud talks about people who had the same dream. But the prescription for it, and they went and to a rabbi and he said, you should do this. Right, to both of them. One did it, one didn't do it. Right? The one that didn't do it didn't believe the dream was going to come true anyway, so he didn't need to do it. Sorry, you didn't get your question, you didn't get my answer.
You didn't give me answer.
Okay, yes.
Are you going to give the same answer to these five people or different answers?
I will give the same answer to all five people. One likes to be consistent. What do you mean you don't agree? How do you know what I'm going to do? He's disagreeing with me. I don't agree that you will give. Oh, yeah? Well, next time five people come to me, right, with the same dream, you'll see that I will. Are you English?
Yes.
Says you're right. I'm finished. Goodbye.